Please join me in welcoming Congressman Kenny Oldthorpe.
Thank you all. First of all, thank you very much, John. That was great, and it's great to be here. Our mantra, and let me echo what my friend Colin had to say, the mantra of the band is no politics, just rock and roll. And part of the reason is that, you know, we found that there are certain issues we kind of have to leave alone. For instance, our keyboard player, John Porter, who couldn't be with us this weekend, is from Las Vegas, Nevada. And so anything relating to Yucca Mountain, off limits. CAFTA, I think, split us 2-3, and so we left that alone as well in the band. But it is a great opportunity to be here with my friend Colin. Let me tell you why I'm here. 1956, 51 years ago, a 23-year-old man and his blushing new bride left a little town called Portageville, Missouri, in the deep boot heel down in Missouri. He had $1,000 in his pocket from his father. That was his stake to make his way, to make his way in the world. And so they drove about 40 miles and found a piece of sand that they decided to put roots down and to have a farm. 2 years later, their only son came along, and they taught him right from wrong and gave him a good, strong work ethic and a good moral foundation. I wish you could have shaken my father's hand. You know, we, especially in politics, you know, the universal greeting is, what do we do here in America? We stick out our hand. You've been doing it these last couple of days. You can learn a lot from somebody's handshake, can't you? You know, if you've been able to shake my father's hand, you would have felt those rough calluses that have been formed from 5 decades of working that piece of ground. You would have seen in the weathered lines on his face the evidence of years and years of squinting into the sun. And if you could have held his gaze, those blue eyes, you might have seen a glimpse into the soul of that man who is the inspiration for this man speaking to you today. I'll just tell you, I couldn't wait to get off the farm. As an only kid, I had all the chores, including packing irrigation pipe in the middle of July in 8-foot-tall corn. And Mom and Dad said, there's another way. There's another life out there. And they were very encouraging. How ironic it was then when Dad passed in November of 2002, and I came to Mom, and of course, Dad's bookkeeping system was stuffing receipts in the ashtray of the pickup. And so after I pieced the books together, and I got a pretty good handle on this farming operation, this 500-acre farm, I said to Mom, you've got three options. We could sell the farm, you'd be set for life. We could try to hire somebody to come in and farm for us, or you and I could do this. Now, I'll tell you, personally, I was thinking about a statewide run in politics and was kind of mulling that over, but I knew that, for instance, our Easter breaks fall during corn planting time. We get off during the month of August and September, which is corn shelling time. And I offered to Mom, I said, you and I, we can do this. And so she thought for a while, and she said, let's do that third one. Let's do that third. Let's carry Dad's legacy alive and keep it forward. And I'm so thankful that we've done that. And she passed a couple years ago, and I continue to run and operate that family farm. I was going through my notes a while ago and actually found my soil test. I need to talk to my fertilizer guy when I get done today to make sure we get our corn ground ready to go. The point of telling you that little family history, though, is to underscore the fact that there are people in Washington, D.C. who are like you, who want to see agriculture succeed. One of them just spoke to you. You know, I'll probably get in a little bit of trouble here, but, I'm proud to be a Republican. Was disappointed about the election results, but I know agriculture is going to be in good stead with Colin Peterson as chairman of the Ag Committee. And so let me just touch on a couple of things. Colin gave you a great glimpse, I think, of talking about the farm bill, and we do want to leave some time for questions. But some of you, as I was flying out here yesterday, and again, as a kid from the farm, and I was just in awe of those majestic mountains. And if somehow you were just plucked up and put on top of the mountain and didn't have to climb that mountain, you'd look around and say, wow, look at the view. This is great. Well, in a similar way, I think, as Colin alluded to, there are a lot of people in Washington that are now saying, man, this biofuels, it's the wave of the future. And yet, didn't make that long trek up the mountain, as some of you have shared your stories. I mean, going back to some of you in this room, I know Shirley last night, he was on stage belting out Harper Valley PTA. The days in the 70s and the 80s with, the gasohol and maybe some substandard product. And then, of course, when price of oil per barrel is $17, it's tough to make a go of it. And, some of you parted with your hard-earned money and lost some back then. Then we had this resurgence, but still having to deal with things like, studies. I won't mention the university, Nick Cornell, but, the studies that say that it costs more energy to produce a gallon of ethanol than the actual energy that gallon will emit, and having to deal with those types of studies. Then, the Clean Air Act of the 1990s, but then methyl tertiary butyl ether was the additive that the oil industry chose. And so ethanol, again, kind of on the sideline. And then, we've had powerful members of Congress. I remember as a freshman year in 1997 to try to extend the ethanol tax incentive. And I was a freshman on this very powerful committee, Ways and Means, that deals with tax law. And but the chairman and, my mentor, Bill Archer from Texas, was not an ethanol guy. And so we took our lumps in a lot of ways. And then the recently departed chairman, Bill Thomas of California, again, was not a strong proponent of biofuels. And yet, you continue to chop your row and try to, make sure that you can at least build some support, which we've done. Go back to 2001 in the springtime, the National Energy Policy Act. There was a lot of discussion in the 2000 presidential campaign. We don't have a comprehensive national energy plan. You may remember, I think, in April or May of that year, this very comprehensive approach that was put forward. Of course, it got kind of swallowed up by September the 11th, but then people were more critical about who was at the table when Vice President Cheney was putting this task force together rather than what was in there. And what was in there was the precursor to all the challenges that we face today, from the electric grid to transportation problems and to biofuels. And then we've continued to have to deal with the criticism. Talk about wind power. Well, some of our friends in the environmental community say that's not good because birds fly into the turbines. What about coal technology? Clean coal, coal to liquid. Well, coal is a dirty fuel. What about nuclear? Nuclear doesn't emit greenhouse gases. Yeah, but you got the nuclear waste, we were told by the opponents. What about biofuels like ethanol and biodiesel? Well, and I remember the head of my Sierra Club in my hometown. We don't like it because it focuses on fossil fuels. And so basically natural gas, according to some, was the only way, out of this, as far as environmental policy, as far as energy is concerned. And yet we have to have that comprehensive approach, and we have to have biofuels as part of that component. We still have new challenges. The ethanol tax incentive, I think, should be made permanent. Again, I knock heads with my own hometown newspaper editor. He's a free marketer. Why can't the ethanol industry stand on its own two feet? And my response and retort is, well, we've subsidized other energy areas over the decades. We're trying to gain a foothold here. And in fact, there's Colin. I've been up to Colin's district in the Red River Valley. And a great question sitting down with the sugar beet farmers. Do we want a domestic sugar producing industry in this country? If you don't, then get away, get rid of the sugar program. But then be prepared to import sugar from somewhere else. And in a similar way, do we want to have domestically produced energy from these United States? And the answer to me is an unswavering yes, of course we do. We have to be comprehensive, but that also means trying to help strengthen the market so that we can then encourage the production of more flex fuel vehicles. Colin, I give you your credit. Minnesota has more, I think, E85 stations around the state. Columbia, Missouri, my hometown, has more E85 stations per capita than you do. You know, but when I stop and get a rental car and I insist on a flex fuel vehicle, you know, and I'm in some place that I don't know where I'm at, you know, I'd like to have an E85 station that's a little easier to find than, you know, having to, you know, find it with using some GPS system. And so things that we could do to encourage, you know, more pumps to make it user-friendly. And again, just, transportation. I mean, the plethora of challenges that you all have been networking about and you all are talking about, you have to make sure that you communicate with your member of Congress. And I'll just leave you with this. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands because it's dark up here and I can't see you. But if I were to ask you to raise your hands, those of you that would feel comfortable picking up the phone and calling your representative in Congress, how many of you would raise your hands? You don't have to do it. Hopefully, everybody here has had the opportunity to sit down with or come to a town meeting like John talked about or, you know, some sort of relationship so that you can advocate for your specific interest to your elected representative in Congress. And that's what makes this system great, is that we don't have Secret Service protection. My wife sent me to the grocery store one time, milk, bread, and eggs. Supper's waiting on you to go get milk, bread, and eggs. A 10-minute trip to the store and back, right? Well, an hour and 10 minutes later, I come rolling in, and I see my wife in the kitchen, hands on hips, and I know, uh-oh. And she said, milk, bread, eggs, how hard could it be? And I said, well, you know, I ran into the mayor, and the mayor wanted to talk about bike trails. And then I had this lady who wanted to my name on a petition, and then I had this attorney in town who wanted to talk about this issue. And so, lo and behold, it took a while. Now, the silver lining to that story is Renee never sends me to the store anymore. But the most important thing is the ability to be accessible. And so take advantage of the fact you are voting constituents. You are from all across the country. And I can assure you that people that don't share your ideas about this market or other ideas are probably contacting your elected representatives, and so you should do that as well. You know, when I put on the blue and gold coat of the Future Farmers of America, this is FFA week. I don't know how many of you knew that, and I get to give a couple of speeches this week back home in Missouri. But I believe in the future of farming with a faith born not of words but of deeds, that opening line in the FFA creed. And the fact is that I think this industry, we are seeing a resurgence. We are seeing a renaissance in rural America. I see a day in the not-too-distant future where kids like my daughters, who are 7 and 4, instead of looking for a way off the farm, are going to be looking to come back to the farm, where we're going to strengthen rural America and really see that renaissance where people aren't fleeing the small towns, but in fact coming back to those small towns. And when they do that, your industry is going to take a large share of credit for that. And for that, I salute you, and thank you for your kind invitation.